Hi, I'm Josh. And Drew thought that meeting a chimpanzee and hanging out with it would be boring. But man, when he met Ben, his jaw was on the floor.
Well played.
Hell yeah. All right. Hey, this is Matt. And God, I know I was going to do a joke about one of the other movies and I can't think of the titles. Like when you kind of know a song, but you're like, if you whistle a little bit of it, I bet I can sing the rest.
Hey.
Hiya. This guy.
Yeah, this is Charlie Dunn Austin. So I would, as Josh has moved further, into more suburban life in their lovely home, and as they go along, and then the trappings of day to day suburban life, I do worry a little bit, just because as much affection as I have for Josh's father. He is a very domestic kind of a gentleman. And so I wonder if at some point Josh will start doing the thing where he parts part of the neighborhood watch, and then they would some asshole would then say, like, oh, it's like a night patrol.
And we are night rangers and we are motoring, and we don't know what's the price for flight. And this is Horse Show Hot Dog. So first up, we have a short called The Littles, or Los Chiquitos, perhaps.
Nice.
And this is a charming combo live action stop motion short. And it's like if the person who wrote The Borrowers was a psychopath.
Yeah.
Or just a keen observer of humanity, because that is basically what would happen to tiny people. They would get stomped on and nails stuck through them. And the world would not be kind to them. Even if they had adorable little sweaters.
Well, I mean, you have to assume that, like, all the stories whereupon people that are our size encounter giants, that those two groups don't get along. So, we're fearing lest we become our enemy in the instant that we preached, we created smaller people in movies, and now we have to be the giant and be evil. So that's kind of fun.
I really admire the artistry of this. I really wanted the next, and maybe it's just a limitation, maybe it's just, whatever, but I really wanted the next thing once the little floorboard starts sort of popping up at the end, like I wanted the next thing to happen. I was like, darn.
Well, this has got an option to be a feature, so you will.
Oh, okay. I was wondering, I couldn't remember. I thought that you had said that that's what the deal was, but
couldn't. That's why I wanted to get this one in as quick as I could, just in case they pull the short in preparation for the feature coming out.
Oh, yes,
yeah.
Now and then, that happens. Like a thing disappears. So I was like, let's do it real quick. So I have no idea what the production schedule on that's going to be or whatever. Maybe it'll never even happen. But I thought it would be worth checking out.
I hope it stays as gleefully psychotic as that was. Like the world has enough of the like Arrietty and Borrower movies. We could have an evil one. It'd be fun.
Yeah, this seemed a little reminiscent of is it a Katie Holmes movie that has the fairies in the basement?
The Darkness or The Darkness.
Something like that, right?
The one that Guillermo del Toro did, yeah.
Yeah.
What is that one called? My goodness.
But it's got like essentially like little tooth fairies that live in like the furnace or some shit, right? In the basement?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, okay. So yeah, just little creatures that also live in your home, and if you cross them, things go poorly. Like, okay, that's a fun idea. Same as that other, was it just that short called Gnomes? Was it just called?
Yeah.
Yeah, yes, that was so much
beautiful
fucking fun.
As that was, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, yeah, give me a little bit of that kind of vibe in this thing, and like, hell yeah. So, and again, anything stop motion kind of makes me happy. Man, stop motion's having a bit of a moment. Doesn't it feel like that? I feel like that's popping up in shorts a lot, and just literally got out of The Mandalorian and Grogu like half an hour ago, and like, there's two just fully stop motion robots in that. And it's like, oh, hell yeah. Like, so cool to see that on an actual movie and movie film for theater level budgets.
Well, and watching some of the little featurettes and then finally seeing the full trailer for Wildwood, like I will freely admit the full trailer for Wildwood, I got all teary eyed. I was like, I just was just like those fucking guys, like they're just the artistry and the dedication is just fucking amazing. There's something about, I don't know. It's a very rare thing. Like you just,
yeah.
It comes in different formats. You have the Greg Nicotero's and Rob Bottin's that were just sort of figuring out, and Tom Savini's that were figuring out new ways to make blood flat of things. And then there's, you know, there's the guys at Leica, and there's the guy, you know, like just the Jim Henson's Creature Shop. And there's just people. Weta is another one. Like just there's these collectives of people that just figure out how to do these things in just amazing ways. And this is sort of like, and I don't know how any sane person could ever do it, but they do. And it's just, it's fucking amazing. So I just, so that part of this, I'm with Josh. I mean, I hope they maintain that level of kind of gleeful, sadistic kind of weirdness. I don't know if they can maintain it depending on how they're going to produce it. But I mean, it's neat to see a different way to interpret these kinds of things. Because yeah, to Josh's point, yeah, there's plenty of things about the kind of mystical, magical, kind of wonderful things. And it's sort of like, you can also kind of go the other way.
Yeah.
And also if the people are kind of the bastards to begin with, then like, then you got something really interesting going on.
Yeah.
Let's see. So I say yes. Watch the thing. It's an
yeah, I would say so for sure.
And then hopefully if things progress and that actually does turn into a feature, I'll try to keep an eye out for it. And if it seems like it becomes a real thing, we'll maybe be able to do a long version of it. We'll find out if Charlie's prediction is correct. There needs to be just a little more thing.
Well, I will always say this all the time. I've mentioned this so many times over the years, but I always go back to Stop Motioning Things. I'll go back to the Spanish one, O El Postolo, which is still to this day is not available domestically. The only way you can actually see it is if you can find the director's website. You can rent it on his website and from Spain, and you can watch it on there. There's not even a way to download it. As far as I could be wrong. It could have changed, but I check in on it from time to time. And but it's just this amazing Lovecrafty kind of thing about these bank robber guys who buried their treasure beneath this house, and like they break out of prison and they get there, but unfortunately the house that they have used is haunted.
Oh no!
And so it's like, but it's all stop motion. And so it's this really beautiful looking thing. Like, you remember the one from a couple of years ago with the kind of marionettes? That's the wrong term. Whatever they call them, the thing from The Swordsman, where they did that. You know, they kind of look like marionettes, but they're sort of That one. It's like if you took that plus James and the Giant Peach and kind of combined them. That's sort of the look of it. Is the way it sort of vibes to the thing. But yeah, to this day, it's still not available domestically. It just drives me nuts. Because it was so cool and creative and interesting. And it's like, man. So, yeah, stop motion things, go find them, because the people who make them are insane.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I appreciate that it exists.
I know it's not Jess's thing, but I'm glad that you can still see stop motion stuff from time to time, Josh.
Yeah, I think there's just the occasional thing that hits her the wrong way. Like, she'll watch Nightmare Before Christmas every year, but like,
oh, yeah.
We watched the Jan Svankmajer Alice in Wonderland.
Oh, that's a rough watch.
And afterwards she said, I usually find stop motion creepy. Like, oh, I wish you would have told me that before we started this.
Because yeah, that's,
I had already seen it. I knew what it was. I just thought.
Yeah, even if you don't think stop motion is creepy, that movie might change your mind.
Yeah, that'll give you the willies.
The White Rabbit.
It's tough one to look at.
So after everything anybody says now, I should just go, said the White Rabbit.
Yeah, that'd be a great way to win friends and influence people.
Said the White Rabbit. So let's talk about primate, if we could, or primate. Because I was surprised at how much this movie kicked my ass and just kind of kicks ass.
Yeah, this movie goes for it.
It really could have been cheesier or like more dark comedy or just like so bad it's good, but they managed to get a creature that didn't read to me like a person in a suit or a CGI thing, and I bought that character. And then just the endless scenarios, just seeing how people can get fucked and get unfucked, and it just goes on just long enough, and then it takes it up a notch with just some of the most gory practical gore effects I've seen in a while that kind of had me squeamish a little bit. So yeah, there were lots of ways that this surprised me. It felt very visceral and like a whole lot meaner than it had any right to be.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is one where I have a very, and in a non-insensitive way to say this, kind of a bipolar relationship with this movie, because like on the one side, as a horror movie, it's like it's well done, like it's very well done for sure. Like it's exceptional in terms of like in terms of a good slashery kind of thing. Like, it's a slasher movie basically.
Oh yeah.
This is one that I really struggle with the, if you stop and think about it, part of it, because it's like there's a lot of things that they take some really, really big licenses with when it comes to...
Well, I mean, pretty much right off the bat, they violate Ape Shall Never Kill Ape, and then you know you're in trouble.
the setup of like where the home is located, it's like on this cliff with this like zero edge pool and all these kinds of things, and it's like in this sort of secluded sort of area. But they mentioned about his enclosure a bunch of times. But like, I mean, I am not a zoologist, but I also know that Hawaii is one of those states that you can't keep an animal like that in a residential area. You can keep it at a zoo or like a research facility. You can't.
Something tells me and most of the people that have a monkey must have enough money to not worry about whether things are legal, right? Because also, if you decide I'm going to build the most expensive house on the island, and where are you going to build it? In the most precarious place to build a house on an island? Like, all these things have to be some kind of symptom of something, and I think it's just extravagant wealth.
That was the first part. I was like, fine, whatever.
In a little Jurassic Park raptor cage like that. That monkey needs more room.
Yeah, and it's like, so that was like, fine. Like, we'll get that part of it.
Yeah.
But then the other part that gets me, that this is the part that I had to really overcome my frustration because I actually enjoy the thing, which I know sounds petty, but the thing that really got me was the early on bit where you have established that he's gotten sick and that, you know, then you have Rob Delaney's character, the veterinarian guy who's going to just go cruising down in this poorly lit enclosure area and go into the goddamn enclosure with a sick animal. And like one of my friends from college, you know, you vaguely knew him a little bit, you know, Vic. He's a zoologist.
More than vaguely.
And you know Vic. And so like, I mean, I used to go out with him out to like the bat, I don't know what they call them bat trails or something. Basically they have like these things where they monitor bat movements and they have these little things where they go like sleep in basically. And then you can kind of monitor where they're coming and where they're going. And I went out with him with a bunch of those things. He used to do stuff, you know, with the zoo, the animal sanctuary zoo in Camp Verde and in Phoenix. I've done a lot of that kind of stuff too. So again, I'm not a zoologist, but you don't enter in a poorly lit cage with an animal of that power by your fucking self. And it's just sort of like so much was predicated on him getting out of the enclosure and then all hell breaking loose. And I was just sort of like, it's like, nah, man, you got to have a second body. Like it made me mad the same way Deborah Logan made me mad. So it's dumb and petty and small, but it does have
what we consider pretty typical slasher. Like you're going to roll your eyes a couple times, but like,
it's, well, that's the thing.
Like, its job is to be fun enough that lets you forgive it, I guess. And I felt like this.
That's the thing. So that's the other part. I'm really glad you said that, Matt, because that's the other part of it. Like if this was also not well made, or if this was draggy, or if this was, you know, that kind of stuff, then I just don't think I ever come back around that corner. But as it stands, that's the thing. It's the other side of this. This is a really well-made, really, really well-made, well-constructed slasher movie, you know? And it's like, so it's kind of one of those things where I just, to be honest, like those things drove me fucking nuts. And I was mad for about half of it. And then I slowly unclenched. And then was like, then by the end of it, I was like, okay, I'm on the ride at that point, you know? And which is good. Yeah. And it's just kind of one of those things, you know, it's just kind of like, I hate saying that shit out loud because it sounds so petty and small,
as you mentioned though, like the fact that you can have those initial, like what the fuck moments, but then even to be, have like the disconnect, like the cognitive dissonance of going like, I like it, but I don't like it, is like, clearly they must be doing something right. You know, like you're not so enamored of it to like ignore like the flaws, but like, yeah, the conflict that you're experiencing is probably a good sign, which is nothing I'd ever really applied to movies. I've been like, that wasn't as good as I wanted. It's like, yeah, but it must have been sort of good. Otherwise, I wouldn't be frustrated. So like I hadn't really thought of it that way. And like, I've watched a couple movies recently that I was kind of frustrated by. And I'm like, oh, maybe they were better than I thought. I'm going to have to rewatch some things. I've learned. I hate it. Yeah, my head hurts.
I did not come here to learn.
Came to kick ass and chew bubble gum when I'm all out of ass.
I'm so lost without you. I know what you're right.
So one other thing that I think really goes in this movie's favor was the casting of what's his nuts? The Deathman.
Yeah, from Coda.
Yeah, Troy from Coda. Yeah. And so like, ooh. You know, I was talking to Kristen about this when I watched this, and I was like, yeah, it does factor in terms of like, you know, when you're teaching primate, you know, sign language and primate communication, all kinds of jazz. So like, it's tangentially related, but I thought it was kind of neat to kind of make a choice to like have a character like that, where it's sort of like, he's also a guy who's like, you know, been widowed, and he's trying to like make a go with this book, and he's trying to think with his daughter and all this kind of stuff, daughters rather. And it's like, but he's also like a guy. Like, he's like a guy. Yeah. Like, if he was in a wheelchair, or if he was, you know, if he was whatever, it doesn't fucking matter. He's just a guy.
Yeah, that's sort of like the heart of the film. Yeah.
And it's like, and I just like think it's such a good choice.
In the rain and sign, curse my deaf ears while he weeps. You know, that's
right. Well, no, like one of my notes was like, when
going about business.
When Hot Boy shows up and they're kind of teasing daughter. And dad does the thing like over Hot Boy's shoulder, a daughter like, this guy, And I'm like, dude, dad's even like cool with you hanging out with the cute boy on the island. Like, this guy is like doing his best to be as chill as possible. What a refreshing thing from the average slasher. It's like, fuck you, mom and dad. I'm going to the party in the cabin in the death woods, no matter what you say. And I'm bringing a machete because there's supposed to be mosquitoes. Like, what?
So I thought that was a really good choice.
A functional family makes this better, I think.
Yeah, it was a really good choice, and just the fact that he's a deaf actor, a deaf performer, like, it doesn't matter. It is tangential to the plot because of primate communication, but like, it's not. It is. Stay in the rain, curse my deaf ears. Because that's the thing. That's the hackneyed nonsense that somebody's gonna do when they're gonna shoehorn in a thing. It's just that stupid kind of choice, and they just don't do that. It's the family dynamic that's there, and it's just like anybody else would be. And I just think it's cool that they made that decision. I was really kind of I really applauded them for doing that kind of thing, and I want more of that. You know, yeah. It's just sort of like,
yeah,
and especially like when, you know, because I watch a lot of anymore these days. I watch a lot of procedural stuff from overseas, stuff from either from Iceland or from the UK or from various, you know, Nordic countries. And some of them are better than other ones. But one thing I've noticed in general the last couple of years, as I really kind of watched a ton more of that stuff, is you'll have people that are like, have a disability or have a something or else. And it's not even a thing. It doesn't even matter. It has no relevance whatsoever. They're just another person. And it's not called upon. It's not drawn upon. It's not, there's no action or attention or nothing.
Yeah, American sort of media is not great at that yet.
Not particularly. No.
Occasionally, they'll have a gay character that is just a character that happens to be gay, I think, in the last 20 years, but that's about as close as we've really gotten.
Yeah, it's just sort of like, it's always has to be a spectacle of some kind or other. And even in things that I like, it's just sort of like, they can't help themselves but to like do a big old shining light kind of moment. And it's just like, you don't need that. Just let it go. So I thought that was cool that they did that in this. I thought that was neat.
Yeah, and I do think they got the relationship between the sisters is just about right, where she's like, younger sister is a little dramatic about older sister going to college and whatnot, but is not like Lilo and Stitch level. Like, she is a normal human level of reaction.
Yeah, she feels like an actual kid. Yeah.
And like,
yeah, I thought that was a good call. That's good call.
Out of place girl, like the girl who was invited along without much enthusiasm, like, she even just gets to be a person for the most part and not like the bitch that gets killed, you know. All of these people do for me read as people. Like, we don't get a whole lot about all their characters, but we don't get like the single placeholder trait that they have.
Well, they're not acting like they're on the real world or whatever. You know what I mean? I feel like in a lot of slashers, you go, okay, let's take personalities and just explode them for television so it's more interesting. It's like, no, these feel like actual people having a fun, chill night at home. Although, okay, anytime there's like some kind of domesticated thing goes bonkers movie, mm-hmm. I feel like we have to address the question. I was about to say the elephant in the room, but I don't think they've made one of those yet.
It would be a very short movie.
Oh my God, the elephant is back in the room. Run. If we don't talk about it, it won't say it's vision is based on movement. That's not run, even T-Rex. Dumbo,
run.
But to me, in any kind of the Animals Gone Bonkers movie, there has to be a moment where you go, any person that lives on planet Earth would have noped out by now. Did you feel like the nope out moment was early in this film or later in the film?
I think for some characters, it's earlier than others. Because there's the girl who just like Ben is sitting next to her bed when she wakes up.
Yeah.
And she's just like, and to me, that would be, I don't give a fuck how domesticated you think this chimpanzee is or how much research you've done. Like, we know that these guys are erratic.
And yeah, they're wild animals.
They're never safe. Like, they have the impulse control of a toddler. And if they decide they don't like you, they can just pull your arms off. So, like, I think just waking up in the house with the chimp that they had not told me about the night before would be enough.
Yeah, I think I'd be mad enough at whoever's house it was that would probably do it. Because, yeah, it's like
if you mentioned the chimp.
Well, if not that, when Chicky Doodle is like finds the pool and the monkey's having his little existential crisis by the pool and he squishes her hand and like dad comes in and is like, yo, it's cool. This is weird. You're a stranger. It's normal. It's fine. Don't worry. I'm like, nope. I think once I'm at the point of like physical injury, no matter how much I was maybe curious about leaving once I found out there was a monkey, like in real life, as soon as I found out there's a monkey, I would not go there. Yeah. But like I feel like they really push credulity with like the minor attack early, which I know is the trope to do the small attack before the big attack, but that felt like it gives away the game and that felt silly. Did that brush up against the roll the eye part with you guys at all?
What do you think, Chad?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of, so like there are times where, you know, I don't know, I had a slightly different thing with the hanger-on friend. Like the hanger-on friend and boyfriend guy both have these moments that don't make any sense like to me, which is that like boyfriend guy who's been a friend of their families for a while from what they tell us is that like, you know, he goes almost instantaneously to kill this fucking wild animal. Like, and it's like, okay, that's, I can understand the idea of reacting to danger, but I mean, like, you also been around this family for a very long time and you know this thing. However, the situations are, it's like he just turns Rambo-y real quick, which I found kind of off-putting. And then also the hanger-on girl too, it's sort of like, it's like, oh, you just kill him. Like, okay. It's sort of like, it's very much like a, it's that first third of the mist in the, when the things, the tensions are starting to rise and you feel people just saying like outlandish things and you're like, no, bigger picture, you dumb motherfuckers. Because I mean, when earlier on, when like there's like, oh, there's a possibility of a threat, not a single one of them goes, okay, so our best course of action is a seal off. And then, you know, he's like, oh, well, we can't get a hold of the veterinarian. Like, yeah, that's okay, cool. Then the next call is emergency services. The next call, it's like, it's just so like, there's an idleness to the whole thing that doesn't make any sense, coupled with this like level of like, oh, just kill the fucking thing. Like, you know, like level of, you know, lack of familiarity with her, the hang on girl, like, okay, fine. But then with the guy, I'm like, I just, that was a big eye roll. It's like, okay, whatever. But then
I
also
thought
like,
about that in the context of him being familiar with the monkey. Cause I was like, oh, high school kid, of course he's going to think I can fight a monkey. Like,
yeah.
You're never dumber than that. And, but it would be, it does, you're right though. I do feel like there should be a reason for him to be given pause, not necessarily cause he'd suddenly be smart enough to realize that there's no contest he'd lose, but because he'd feel bad. You know, like I think he would be stupid enough, but I think he would feel bad enough from having theoretically hung out with this family and this monkey for what, months, years at least.
Well, and they show that in the house too. Like, I don't know, you probably noticed, but like at certain points in this movie, you see early on before things kind of go sideways, you see some stuff shown in the background where there's like a rope ladder where the stairway is. And then there's like a little play box. I can't think of, there's a term for them. I can't think of what they're called. It's like a box, like a wooden box that they use with chimps and bonobos and stuff like that, where it's like a thing.
Like an enrichment tool.
It's like a toddler's toy. Yeah, it's like a toddler's toy, but there's like a, It's like a reward system toy. I just can't think of the name.
Oh,
the
like when you put your dog treat in a Kong and they try to get it out for like a
half. Yeah. It's like that. Oh. It's like the size of an entertainment center, but it's that kind of a thing. And but they have it off the living room, like in a little breezeway thing. Like they never actually really, it never comes into the story at all. But it's like you can see it there along with some other couple other things.
It shows familiarity. So, yeah.
Yeah, it shows a level of like comfort, which I mean, to the movie's credit, like that would also explain. Like not immediately running for the hills instantaneously in that situation, you know, the same way of like I heard a funny noise in the basement. I should go check, you know, that kind of thing. Right. It's sort of, yeah, I always joke about the Charlie shaped hole in the wall. Like it's sort of it's like, but you know, when you can break down that kind of thing and just give a little bit more time, then it's like, well, now we're extra. Well, extra fucked.
I felt like it had that. Showcasing their naivete mm-hmm. more than anything in those early scenes, that just we think of this as like a harmless, like intelligent creature, and he's been in our home, like he's our friend, he would never do anything like that,
which is the story every single animal attack victim tells.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah, so it's like that actually makes sense, just to make this family have that same perspective. Yeah.
So when things start going hinky and he seems a little off, they don't think this creature could snap and kill me at any moment that it wanted to, because he's Ben. Of course he wouldn't do that.
Yeah, perfectly said, Joshua. That's applying that, but that projecting that humanity thing that mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys ever saw that movie that Draft House, back when it was Draft House, had championed that movie Roar. Did you guys ever see that?
Dude, Roar is a I was about to say it's a beast of a movie. I'm on fire for dad jokes that I'm refusing to tell properly.
Man. Man.
No, that's a hell of a watch, man.
But that is this, I mean, that is this sort of like, because you just know it's coming. You know it's coming. That's the level of casual like slackness to it. It's just like, it's like, motherfucker, you're just moving through the empty chambers of the gun and Russian roulette. I mean, it's just a matter of time. And you're like, that level of ego, that level of, but then you go on this side of it, it's almost, there's a level of naivete mixed with a level of sweetness almost with the daughter. Cause it's like, well, I can just, if I'm just calm and I've been trained, I know how to, you know, like lower my hand and I know how to, you know, all this kind of stuff. And it's like, so there's a level of naivete, but then there's also a level of like, well, I can deal with this situation. I can, you know, I can do that part of it. And it's sort of, and so it just buries them further in the whole thing. And it's sort of like, and so, and yeah, that's where the thing I go, you know, I wrestle with, which is just sort of that thing of like, are you going to rules not see it to death, or are you just going to kind of like take it for what it is? Like,
I think,
which we're going to get to in Night Patrol, which is a whole different barrel of monkeys.
Yeah.
But you also,
my joke I was going to do in the opener. Fuck. I was going to do a joke about how it was difficult to watch Night Patrol because for a movie about vampires, I had some real trouble figuring out what the stakes were. that was the opening joke.
It wasn't a barrel of monkeys joke at all.
No, sorry. That was me having a eureka moment that was unrelated to your otherwise brilliant joke. I'm sorry. That was...
So I'll allow it. I don't know about Josh.
That occurred in real time.
Yeah, I don't want to assume, you know, Josh's stance, but I mean, I'll allow it. I think it's perfectly acceptable.
Yeah, it's true. This movie does have a lot of hurdles to get through to get us to this point. And I think it works sometimes in the movie's favor, though, because it would be crazy for there to be rabies on Hawaii.
Yeah.
There are rabies shots, right? Like, that just doesn't happen. But the fact that it would be crazy means that if it were to happen, people would probably not jump to that as their first thought when they're seeing
him.
Even something foaming at the mouth, like, what the fuck is wrong with this thing? Well, we know it can't be rabies. So
I think I was thinking about that a little bit with that same thing with the, you know, everybody pretty much being familiar with the monkey for ages and blah, blah, blah. And all that, then, because there's also part of the group think of when things go a little hinky, you don't want to be the first one to say, hey, guys, I think this is fucked. Because if everybody else goes, what are you talking about? It's perfectly normal. Like, there's a social risk there. And like, depending on the situation and the severity, like we all weigh that. And sometimes it happens almost without thinking. And sometimes like people tell you like, yeah, I was uncomfortable, but everybody else seemed fine. So I kind of, we went to the other place or we stayed the extra hour or some kind of out of character thing. And it's like, I wonder if the neighbor, the hanger on girls, like, I know nothing about monkeys. I've never seen one this close in real life. If they say it's fine, do I look like a complete psycho if I freak out? Yeah. You know? Like, it's, I don't know that that would be enough to keep me there, but I might it be. Certainly at certain points in my life, it would be. So, I don't know. This has all made me like this movie more, actually. So, that's good.
I just was so impressed with how tense it got and stayed. And just the way they kept, like, jacking up the stakes and just making it somehow more tense moment by moment. There's a little bit where it seems in danger of maybe getting a little repetitive because it's going to be, okay, they're going to try to make a sortie into the house to get X item. And then one of them is going to get killed in some kind of way. And then the next group's going to come. But I think
if they just waited around, you'd know X going to give it to you. So
exactly. But I think as soon as I started feeling that way was when the other dudes showed up.
Yeah.
And that broke the formula a little. And then we had Dad coming back because he can't get any answers to his texts, of course.
Yeah, I thought even the, and maybe because as we mentioned early on, these all kind of feel like real people that I didn't hate, which is sort of, you know, usually anathema to the slasher genre. But like, I did think even adding in the drunk dial guys from earlier to just literally be two more bodies. Like, even those guys, like, they're not necessarily douchebags, I don't think. I can't remember for sure. But, like, yeah, they're drunk. They're going to go party at someone's house. Like, I've gone to parties by a phone call from a random girl with friends. Like, that doesn't make them bad people. So, like, even the guys that are just plot meat aren't necessarily as appalling as some of the people we see in some of the slashers that we don't like as much. So, even that I thought was kind of impressive. Is, like, you can still be like, oh, man, these guys didn't deserve that, you know? They weren't like fucking with the monkey earlier in the movie. And now it's like, haha, good.
Which absolutely would have been the thing.
I mean, that would be the 80s version, I think.
Oh, of course. Yeah. They're the one that are antagonizing it earlier in the day or whatever.
Throwing rocks at it or whatever. And then all of a sudden, yeah. Haha. That just changes the entirety of like, oh, shit can just be crazy because nature to like revenge movie. And like that tone difference is very different because then it's, you know, was it Canine? Was that the cybernetic dog one that was super awesome?
Not the one with Jim Belushi, I assume.
No, that was the Belushi one. Something like that. Man's Best Friend?
Man's Best Friend. That's the one that's got the robotic
dog. And like, yeah, then yeah. It's like when the animal is out for vengeance, that's a little different. Jaws 3 plays differently than Jaws.
I was just, God damn you, Matthew. I was going to say Jaws 3. I was going to say Jaws 3 because he's like, he takes his little vacation jaunt up to the Cape. You know, it's like, okay, whatever.
Yeah. Well, I mean... I just made myself laugh. If you knew you could go meet Michael Caine in person, wouldn't you take a quick trip to the Cape if you were that shark?
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, you know,
that's Michael Caine. He's very famous. He looks at one eye, doesn't blink.
Michael Caine. Good man. Wait. Michael Caine.
Michael Caine.
You have to say my cocaine to say his name.
I think
name
it works.
With his accent. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
So, I bet he used that to get laid. Yeah.
Overall, super happy with this. And yeah. Just the right amount of like double fake for the ending and then not trying to like have seven chimps waiting in the forest who begin to howl and, you know, like a ridiculous stinger ending. Like they had a good little. Like,
oh, that would be so upsetting.
That would be crazy.
Yeah, this thing like it stuck its claws in real early, and I think I really like movies about wild animals just being wild animals and being underestimated apparently, and this one, yeah, it definitely hit all of the right buttons on the board to make the
doing it land the plane.
Yeah, I would agree. I'm kind of with Josh. When they can construct a good suspenseful thing, it does, like, because you're looking at this lovely home that has all these technological advancements and all this kinds of stuff. And it's really, it's like, but they're fucking trapped. It's like, it's just, you can't, you know, you're just, you're stuck. Like you can't, even though you're just, you're in a home, it's a normal thing. And it's just sort of like, no. You don't have the solution. You take those things for granted. And it's like, if it's done well, you really kind of clenches up the old butt cheeks. You know, it's just like, oh, it's very tense. And it's like, I don't think it's as easy to do as it seems like it is. I think it's easy to fuck that up, actually. Mm. So it's kind of, it's impressive when you can make it super, super claustrophobic in the way that, you know, nobody becomes John McClane necessarily. Like, and when people try, they, it doesn't work out so good.
Hell yeah.
And so for me, I would give this an 8 out of 10. I don't think it's going to change the world or anything, but it is just a perfectly made and put together thing. Just like very exemplary of its genre. I like it.
Hell yeah.
One of the good ones.
Yeah, I'll go just a titch higher. Like I said, I think even just from us talking about it and kind of how well they handled character motivations and like what we all know about monkeys and whatnot. I think they did their best to make things kind of hang together. But I think more importantly, like whether the idea or maybe the assignment was you got to make a horror movie with a chimp. Like, I believe they first and foremost went, what are some crazy, scary shit you could do with a chimp? And then they probably worked backward. And I think if you're going to make this kind of movie, that's the way to do it. Because every time the monkey does something scary, that shit is legit scary and awesome. And it's gorier than I expected. And you don't hate the characters, which is all a lot of things that you get disappointed in from slasher flicks. And yeah, this is super fun. So yeah, titch higher than I would initially say, and I'll say 8.5 out of 10. Poof, flinging monkeys. That wasn't even that creative. Oh well.
It's one of the best things from Madagascar Awards is the one signing monkey. Just, well, of course we're gonna throw poo at them. So, I love that. It's one of my favorite lines. That one and the when the penguins make it to Antarctica, they're standing there on the ice floe for a good 15 seconds. Yeah. And then just goes, well, this sucks. It's fucking goddamn brilliant. It's just so brilliant.
Good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be the low man on the totem pole, like, just because, like, as an enjoyable, like, well-made slasher thing, like, it's really well done and vicious. And, yeah, a lot gorier than what you expect. You expect a few, like, a, you know, few kind of cutaway, you know, True Lies level of machine gun fire kind of violence, and you don't – no, it's, you know, it's a little more vicious than that. So it's and to that point, it makes me wonder about their when they, because they released this came out what, in January, I think, right?
Yeah, so I think so.
Yeah, so they came out like in January, which is sort of like, which was a fascinating choice in and of itself. But it's like this is not your mass, this is not a mass market paperback version of a thing. Like they don't pull back on some of the stuff, and it's like, oh, so. I don't know. I don't know what they thought was going to happen necessarily. Because like, there's one thing where you have violence in like Deadpool or something, or like Zombieland, and then you have something like this, which is a little bit more intimate and a little bit darker and a little bit more. It's a little bit more. Little leans more towards the old fuck territory. And so it's sort of like, it's interesting to see how it was received, because it was like, it's been well reviewed, you know, by and large. But I don't know that it made a big noise box office wise, and so it's sort of like makes me wonder, because like it's a little bloodier and darker, you know.
Looks like it got close to 40 million internationally.
So all told about 40. So I mean, with marketing and whatever, it's it's into the black, you know. Certainly, I mean, it took care of its people a lot better than like Renfield did for comparison.
Yeah.
So that's not a bad thing, but it is interesting, because when you get something like this that is a fair bit darker and more violent, and it gets kind of pushed into the kind of the mainstream kind of channel, it's sort of like, I wonder how that, you always wonder how that goes, you know. But I'm gonna be the low man on the totem pole here, like, you know, like I said, not for any level of spite. Like I said, I did come around on my frustrations and whatever. So I was gonna say 7. I'll say 7 out of 10, 7 out of 10, 7 out of 10. Just monkeying around.
But we're too busy singing to put anybody down. Dun,
dun. Well, I was actually gonna be a little bit lower, but then the more I thought about it, I was like, no, but there's some extremely well constructed things in this. Like it's yeah. You know,
but again,
like,
for something as niche and genre specific as this, like that's a pretty good rating. So mm-hmm. Yeah. This is another one of those ones, like you kind of mentioned, like this coming out, because I was just looking at my AMC app and like, yeah, I saw this on January 11th, never forget. And the idea that like you make this insane, not mass market, not a lot of, you know, there's no four quadrant appeal on this horror movie. And you go, got to dump it in January or February. And I go, just dump it in October. If you're going to dump it, just dump it in October, when at least the people that like these things might be more willing to see it. Like, God, I'm going to keep barking up this tree forever, I guess. But like,
oh, no, I know. It's like, I mean, look at the shit that's coming out in May. May.
Yeah.
What are they doing with some of this stuff? It's like I know that Obsession's gotten to like 80 something million, which is great for them. And I'm glad for them, awesome. Of course. But it's sort of like that is the exception. It's just like you don't get the casuals wanting to go see a Splatterfest in, you know, in spring.
Yeah. Well, one of the assignments for next week was another January release this year. So it's just like, yep, there's good shit that just came out at difficult times. So
yeah, it's sort of, you know, one of those things. But yeah, so you know, like I said, no lingering malice.
Yeah.
Okay. Good stuff. All right, we'll take a quick break and then we'll be back with our other two. So next we'll talk about Night Patrol or Patrulla Nocturna.
Cool.
And Night Patrol supposes that there are vampires in the LAPD as part of a special like anti-gang task force, and that there is like Zulu tribal magic that can counter them, and mm-hmm. There are practitioners that, you know, like actual magical artifacts that you can use against them. And like, that is a fun setup, if like a little on the nose, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like for maybe 2/3 of it, it just kind of walks, really slow walks that idea, and just kind of sticks with the slice of life of the, you know, the housing project that the people live in. But then the last 20 minutes get agreeably weird. It just takes a really long time to get there. Like, I'm all for levitating Justin Long, opening up his face all Predator style. Like, all of that is excellent. And then, like, the glowing spear and all that shit, beautiful.
Yeah, but I guess... I think
it's really, like Charlie would say, hammock-shaped. And one end of the
hammock. Yeah, and I guess... And the bucket tree. Like, my joke that I suddenly remembered in the opening part here, where it was like, okay, I couldn't tell what the stakes were. Like, that was based on the actual problem I was having for at least the first act, although maybe even, I don't know, I just really had trouble with the pacing and grokking all of this. But, like, okay, so you've got Justin Long and his partner. Justin Long is kind of a shitbird, but kind of maybe the only not shitbird on the force, but he wants to get on the shitbird squad of the force.
Well, he wants to infiltrate and bring him down, right?
But I was not entirely sure, I guess, based on how the things were playing out, exactly who to trust to be what early on. And so then, especially when you go, I get it. Like, they're bad because they're all like white supremacists. And then it's like, oh, no, they're vampires. Or no, they're not actually vampires because they put in fake teeth. They're white supremacists. They're like, haha, we are just into vampires. And I think they were real vampires, but they did that to, like, was it hide DNA? I forget. There was some reason for that, wasn't there? But, like, I just was trying to figure out, like, what exactly, like, who's our big bad? And is it generational trauma? Is it, like, race relations? Is it monsters? And, like, I felt like I had trouble grasping which faction was trying to push which narrative. Clearly, there's, like, a fraught relationship with, like, Justin Long's character and his father and something about the force. Obviously there's all kinds of racial tension. There's maybe a supernatural thing, because early on I didn't know if that was meant to be just like a thing that would like throw you off from whatever. So it was like, is it good cops versus bad cops? Is it, I guess this is almost the same question, is it shitty racist cops versus black people? is it vampires that are actual vampires? Is it like regular dudes that are white supremacists putting in vampire teeth? Like, it felt hard to tell, like, who was, like, I assumed, like, the just average people living in the neighborhood, like clearly they're just people, like they must be like the good guys. So whoever's like on their side in the fullness of time is probably the good guy. But I felt like that was unclear to me for longer than I wanted it to be in the movie. And I don't know if that's, again, me just being dumb or if that was just, there was so much happening early on that it was hard to keep track of. I don't know if you guys had the same experience or not.
Yeah, that's the thing I was telling myself was that like it was I just have not encountered a thing in a while that's this overwritten where it just sort of like it just can't get out of its own fucking way with every trope that you can possibly throw in there. And it was just sort of like it's like enough already. Like pick the story and then do that story. Like that's the story. Just pick the one. Like pick it. Pick the one you need to pick, like crying aloud. And so that was the part that just frustrated me to end degree. Like I said, I kind of walked away from this being pretty frustrated. I was just like, God damn it, man. Like just the movie at the end, that story, that's a cool story. Like all this ridiculous overwrought, like the fill-in partner guy who's like gross and racist and like, oh, I'll bring a shotgun and start shooting people. Like, fuck off. Like it's just it's so boring and dull and uninteresting. Like it's a stretch in like Reservoir Dogs timeline. Like it's like enough already. Like it's not interesting. And then you get the Justin Long part of it, which is like, you know, where is he coming from? Where is this part of it going? And where's that part of it going? But then we can't keep telling that story because we have to stop for 20 minutes and get into this sort of gangland stuff that's, you know, it's just tenured and silly. And we go back to our main story again. And I sort of like go on for that for 5 or 6 hours. And then you go back to this other thing. And then you sort of, it's, I don't know, it's just one of those things where it's like every part of it was just so overwritten. It just drove me nuts. Absolutely drove me nuts.
I did kind of wonder, and like I'm in no position to know anything about it, but if this was like gangland movies or like gangland. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. You know, like how Stranger Things is set in 80s movies.
Yeah.
And not in the 80s. I was like, is this
set in what rap songs taught us in the 90s? Yeah.
Or is it like, is this an authentic thing that somebody has witnessed? Or is this what they saw in movies in the 90s and absorbed? Or are the movies in the 90s like that because that's what it's like in the projects? And I go like, boy, do I feel ill-equipped to sit and talk about what life may or may not be like in the project.
Oh, yeah. That's certainly an aspect of it for me. But, like, at the same time, like, regardless of how much I understand the experience of living in that situation, I do think, at least speaking narratively as putting a movie together, that's a better story, or at least a story that could be better told, I think, if you just drop all the Justin Long character stuff entirely. You have the guy who was a Crip, grew up in that neighborhood, is now a cop, wants to get away from that life. His younger brother is starting to get involved. Who's he going to stay loyal to, the cops or his brother and the neighborhood? And then, oh shit, not only are the cops their usual shitty selves, but they're also vampires. That's plenty of plot.
Yeah, that's it. That's all you need. You
don't need another guy that has multiple partners that also has to deal with daddy issues, and then his dad also comes back to life having thought he was dead forever, motivating the entire journey, and is a vampire. It's like, wow, that's two whole separate movies that became one half-assed movie. So yeah, I think the idea is fun. It just doesn't need to be this big. It feels like it just reached beyond its grasp. Maybe that's the problem.
God, yeah, if you just summarize the middle and you have that opening scene of him in the police office with the thing stabbed into his side.
Yep.
And you kind of fast forward a little with more inserts of him in the police office, and then just get you to that point where you understand what the thing in his side is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And because to me, after he pulls out the giant case that says what heavy missile artillery or some bullshit, it's like, oh, what the fuck is in there? And then he opens it like, oh, cool. So like he becomes a superhero, and that's fantastic.
Right.
And it, it does take a goddamn long to get there, and it feels like this should be the Zulu warrior origin story, or the like daddy didn't love me and also is a vampire now story. And you know,
well, that's another part of it that kind of like, yeah, that's another, you know, to your point, Josh, like intermixing it with kind of cuts back to the police station or whatever else, like that would be a much better vehicle than just, we're just going to get on the trope train and then just like every like hackney's such a mean word, but like just every kind of fill in that's just,
well, it's just, it's all very broad first thought, first draft. Whereas like the parts that seem good, the parts that like were the story I was interested in, felt like they actually were like someone had an idea, someone was telling a story. But like the cop drama within the department is all boilerplate, I think, right?
Yeah, it's very much a cut and paste kind of a feel to it. And it's like, and it just, unfortunately, it just takes just an ungodly amount of time to get through all of those things. And then also, like, to Josh's point, it gets into precarious territory, because I, you know, to quote Steve Martin, you know, like, I did not grow up a poor black girl in the South, you know, sort of like, yeah. I can't necessarily step into that realm. But I also know when something feels inauthentic in terms of its, like, saturation. And I just, I don't know, like, over the years at different festivals and different things, like, I've certainly seen my fair share of, like, of the Korean and Thai and Spain, Spanish and Chilean and Mexican and all different kinds of people from all over the world that are like speaking to their experiences or whatever else. And I don't know, at a certain point, like I said, I'm not going to say I'm an expert on anything, on all that kind of things, 'cause that's ridiculous. But I also know when something feels like stuffed, like just, and that's kind of what a majority of this feels like. It just feels very stuffed. And it's sort of like, and I just, you're just not gonna blow. It's like the SNL sketch with like the high schoolers doing like the kind of like the thing of like, it's like, oh, I have AIDS, like, oh, get away from him, don't touch him, he's dirty, and like that kind of stuff. It has that kind of feel where it's like, I mean, like I said, I'm not gonna invalidate somebody's personal experience or lived in experience. I don't mean that way, but it's like the way it's presented and the way that the dialogue is, because the dialogue in this just, oh my god, this killed me. Oh my god, it killed me. So many words can be done with so many less words. It's just like, I think of great dark, you know, police villains, and I think about, you know, I think about Gary Oldman in The Professional, or I think about Bad Lieutenant's a good example of this, or you know, what's the fucking I'm forgetting.
I was going to say French Connection, but...
French Connection, yeah. That's a great example. That motherfucker, that lieutenant dude, is like one of the most evil characters.
Yeah.
And it's like, but he doesn't spend all day just like, just talking ad nauseum.
Right.
Like, it's, and so that's, I think that's this movie's biggest fault, I think, is the overstuffedness just gets, it's endless and it's draggy. And so when you get the cool story, the interesting story, like it's just buried. It's absolutely buried. And it's just like, man alive. So I mean, I really admire their effort, I admire their creativity. I think the core story is fascinating and cool. Mm-hmm. I just wish they would have told that story, would have been the thing I would have chosen to do.
It is also funny to have this group like Night Patrol is known for just going and obliterating people, it really seems like.
Yeah.
And yet everyone in the police force is super on board and really wants to be part of it. And just the our main character guy wanting to join, he keeps going and going and going. We're like, dude, from space, we can see that this is the white supremacist organization.
Well, and that's why I wasn't sure, right?
Like, what is your deal, guy? Why are you so obsessed with them? And you hope that you keep asking if you can be added to the squad. And they're like, fucking dude, we're the KKK, basically. Do you not? How do you think that? Okay.
Well, I had to make sure they believed me. So all my neighbors are dead, but I wrote a scathing Yelp review.
Oh what? yeah, that is it, getting the one other bitchy gripe that I would be mad at myself if I didn't say was this also in a world that exists with no cell phone cameras.
Like, oh yeah, that's true.
None of these antics have been filmed ever. Like, you know, one of the big things I was mentioning before about the Scandinavian and UK kind of procedures or whatever else is they talk a lot about CCTV and like closed video, and it's like that's because throughout Western Europe it's a kind of a part of daily life. It's sort of a thing. The two series that they picked up on Peacock, which if you've not watched them, absolutely watch them, which is Capture. It's fucking amazing. It's so goddamn good. It's unbelievably how good it is. The guy who played Tiger from Green Room is the lead in the first one. But it deals with the idea of like of deep fakes and things, but it deals a lot with CCTV stuff. And it's like, cause this is sort of a part of sort of life. And so like in this world, we have guys like draining people's blood and big old blood tanks, all this kind of stuff. No motherfucker two blocks away with a iPhone 17 or a, you know, or whatever with a zoom lens or whatever else never recorded any of this.
Yeah, some dipshit influencer trying to do duck face in the Starbucks across the street.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's just sort of like it's like, what for fuck's sake?
Well, this actually, though, this is a thing I've started to wonder about. I think because there's a couple movies. I hadn't really thought about it with this one, but there's a couple movies I've watched lately where I've realized they really haven't mentioned the what we now consider obligatory cell phone disclaimer. However, we're going to collect them. It's girls' weekend, or oh, there's no,
yeah,
whatever it is, right? But there's a couple movies I watched lately where they didn't have the obligatory explanation that there's no cell phone scenes, and I kind of had the thought of like, wouldn't it be nice if we all just agreed to shut up about that? and we go, listen, if you're gonna go see like a scary movie, horror movie, thriller, maybe political action film, something like that, with anything with a spy or a psycho, like, we just, can we all agree cell phones don't exist? And we just, because otherwise the movies are tough. Like, we need to find some kind of shorthand to get to you. There could still be a guy three blocks away you don't know about, because we're running out of ways to have that. And, you know, odds are this will get solved by creativity. Everything does. But I do think in the same way I kind of started forgiving bad CGI because it's more fun to like a movie, I wonder if it would be more fun to just not worry about cell phones all the time. This is not to, like, knock the idea of that being a criticism here. Just, like, this is one of the things that makes me think about that.
I just tend to notice more if they manage to keep the cell phones and keep them working and have, or at least have reception, and then continue to work the plot no matter what. Because there are plenty of times when, like, I'll be out shopping and Jess will call, and that means my phone vibrates and I just don't feel it until I get back to the car, you know, like.
Or you're driving, so you can't answer it right that second.
Or your phone's on the charger and you're checked out for a minute. Like, it can happen. I think they do a decent job in Primate with that a little bit. Is just like, he's sending the messages and they can receive them. They just can't respond, or like he can't tell what's going on. So Night Patrol, I just got to say, the more that I want to just dismiss this, the more my brain keeps insisting on that final act.
Yeah.
It's so freaking cool. And I really, really like everything about it, except for, you know, the daddy issues stuff with Justin Long. Like, once he grabs the guy and lifts him off the ground, this movie just does not stop. It just does not start for that. So, you know, for me, it was like a 6 out of 10, just on the strength of that last bit alone. And I kind of want to see the movie that starts there.
Yeah, that's a little more generous than I can be. I think, like, that brief rundown of like the plot points that I found most interesting, I think that is still like the ideal movie I'd like to see from this. Again, you know, who the fuck knows? Maybe this is exactly everything that they wanted to say. And great, then that's cool. It's just maybe not for me. But it also feels like, and I don't know enough about, you know, this seems like a sophomore effort maybe, like, that's still a point in someone's career where you try to stuff every idea you've ever had into a project because you never know if you get another chance. And this feels overstuffed. And I'm hoping that's the kind of thing that, like, okay, now if you feel like you've gotten that, you know, gotten the wiggles out, can you just stick to a leaner story? And then with that focused energy, I think this is the kind of thing where it's like, yeah, there's good ideas. This could evolve, but I just don't think this is there. So yeah, like 4.5 out of 10.
I do wonder a little bit about whether this filmmaker had to do some calculus about if this is the story about these two black characters, this is then going to be a black movie and it's going to be marketed differently and it's going to get a different quality of attention. And if I really want to get this story told and get it sold, maybe we have to have an audience insert who's white. I could definitely see that being the sad, you know, kind of mental arithmetic that you have to do to say, yeah, like, how much further will people push this if Justin Long's in it, right?
And, you know, explains a little bit more of the stunt casting of CM Punk, who is continuing to prove he is not the crossover star that John Cena or The Rock are.
Yeah, he's not helped by the dialogue either.
No, he's not given a lot to work with, but yeah, I was just, every time he's talking, I'm like, Jesus Christ, like, you've given promos that will send chills down my spine. The dude can work, but this isn't, yeah, bad.
I like his other thing.
The woman in the house across the street? What was it?
Yeah,
the one on the third floor?
Yeah, that guy. That's good.
The woman in the third floor of the house across the street?
Yes, next to the room with a view of the staircase of the window.
Staircase of death, yeah. Damn it.
Based on the novel Bush by Sapphire?
You both are reading my mind like a half step quicker than I can think things.
That's amazing. Like, I'm clairvoyant and I can read minds. You'll read what you're going to be thinking tomorrow. Okay, so Charlie, what do you got for rating on this guy?
I'm kind of the low man on the totem pole here. I just, like I said, I spent a lot of this being very frustrated, and it was just sort of like, we've talked about, you know, like it being overstuffed and being saturated and just like really focusing on the story that's not interesting. And I just, I don't know, like it just takes it like half as much words and just, you know, and I'm going to say this out loud in a way that I hope it doesn't sound bad, but like the black story in this is the story. Like, that's not, all the other stuff is not. I mean, once you get into the things where we have the third or fourth presentation sequence with Gerbil McDillit and the rest of them, it's like, I don't fucking care. I'm not interested in that, like, at all. I'm interested in the people that are fighting them. You know, like, it's just sort of, that's more interesting and it's more compelling. And it's like, and more care has been put in that part of the story. So, like, tell that story, damn it. Like, that's the one I want. I don't want one more cop procedural about shitty cops or whatever else. Like, segment them off. Logic out how they can be segmented off. Is it, like, is it magic? Is it, like, mind control? Or what? How is this that part of it? And then leave it. Like, that's all you got to do. Like, and then the core story of this, the younger partner fella and that part of it, like, that's your story. Like, that's the interesting story, as evidenced by how cool the last 20-some-odd minutes of it are. And it's like, tell that fucking story. And so, but as it stands, it just felt like an absolute, you know, like kind of trope-a-thon type of thing where it's like, it just gets in its own goddamn way for an endless amount of time. So like I said, I'm going to be a little bit on the totem pole here. Like I said, I've been a lot more frustration than I think I realized. So I'm going to be kind of low on this. I'll say 4. Mm-hmm. 4 out of 10. 4 out of 10. Just so much and so much. So much.
Like, they just keep going. The dialogue, there are so many things that they say with way too many words, and they just keep going. They talk so much with the dialogue.
Well, allow me to reintroduce myself again for the first and last time.
Well, honestly, what was happening was I kept getting distracted in my brain because there's on SNL UK, they did a song. I was trying to find it to send to you guys, but I couldn't find it quick enough. But they did this, like, they did it as a country, like a digital short, but they did a country western song. Like, you know, and it starts out with, like, why do people in TV and movies always have their ringers on loud? And they're, like, showing people texting, boop, 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 and whatever else. And it keeps going, whatever else. And it's like, why is everything expositional? Like, you know, like, it's like, oh, you mean my brother, your son? it's so fucking perfect. It's like, ah, it's excellent. And it's like, but I kept thinking of it in relation to this whole damn movie. it's like, just so many less words will do the job. For the love of God. Gracious. Anyway.
Well, then let's talk about Whistle, or El Silbo, Silbo Saggins.
Joshua. You are silly bitch is what you are.
That is a medical term, sir. That's the original Latin for the uvula.
Tell me the Sackville Bagginses don't sound like something that sags every now and again. It's
well, especially as you get older.
Yeah. Just thinking of how for a while with Oliver, when he was like talking over me or something, I would go, Bilbo Baggins. And then we go, I'm not trying to rob you. And, you know, he loved it. And then one day I just went, Bagbo Bilkins. And that was the funniest thing he'd ever heard. So now I will have to do that at some point. Just set about seconds.
Good. You got that voice down pretty damn well. That's
decent Ian McKellen, actually.
Yeah.
Lovely. Well, the whistle, I think where I landed on this is that this is a 90s movie that has somehow escaped containment and popped through a wormhole. I think this, like, I wish that this had been something that I could have watched like right after Urban Legend or something like that. And I feel like the filmmakers had that wish too. And they did the thing that apparently you just have to do now, that this is set in the present day and everyone is styled like it's 1998.
Yeah. Yeah.
The cars they drive and all their shit and even their stock characters are, because they are like the jock and the emo and the nerd. And yeah, anyway.
This is my, I won't say first problem necessarily, my first discomfort with the film. So, dear listeners, depending on your life experience, you may or not know a band called The Distillers. And so, if you know who, you know, and again, depending on toy trends lately, I don't know what they are. If you know who Barbie is, so Barbie was the doll, the aspirational doll that, you know, generally were marketed to girls to be a thing you would dress up and play with. So the Distillers are a punk band led by Brody, who is an awesome aspirational punk band artist. And then Skipper was introduced later. And was Barbie's younger sister, kid sister, kind of not as cool, didn't sell as well. And I'm watching Daphne Keene wear everything I've seen Brody wear on stage in this movie, going, we're getting the Skipper to Barbie in this movie. Because she's punk-ish.
Yeah, and part of it, I kept thinking about that too, because like, yeah, it's so funny you brought the Distillers, because like, you know, one of my first crushes that I can remember, if you think back, you can't remember the first one or else. One of my very first ones that I can remember back in Prescott, Arizona, small town, northern Arizona, was Joan Jett, was seeing the video for I Love Rock and Roll and being like, we don't have that here. And like, what is this?
Like, I got to move.
Super, super gorgeous girl who's like snarly and like playing the guitar and like, what am I seeing? I was like, holy God. And it was like, and then, you know, fast forward down the line a little ways and then Bernie Dale shows up and you're like, holy God. It's like, you know, I don't have to be a pig about it or anything, but it's just like, that just, you feel that in the back of your knees. Mm-hmm. Holy mackerel. And it's like, and I kept thinking about, it's so funny you remember the Distillers, because like watching this, that young lady who plays the lead in this, it's like, it's not,
it's X-23, F- baby.
Yeah, she's, you know, from Logan, yeah. And it's like, and I kept thinking, like, you know, it's not her fault. She is built how she is built. It's her face as she is her face. But it's like, she has this thing as if you were building an avatar in a thing. If you're like, I want her to be Joan Jett-esque or like Bernie Dale-esque. And so it's so funny that you mentioned that, because it's just like, I kept thinking, like, there's scenes in this movie where I think she's supposed to be softer or more like approachable or pleasant, and it just, she can't do it, because she's got the face she has, but nothing wrong with it. It's just sort of like, it's just one of those things. It's like, you know, if you cast Michael Clark Duncan to be like a surgeon, you gotta kind of explain that the tool, you're gonna have to, at some point, have to address his big old hands.
Yeah.
And like, where does he get the scrubs? So yeah.
Well, and that's the thing.
Certainly not from TLC, but how this movie changes if you just swap Daphne Keene and Sophie, what's her name, from Yellow Jackets?
Yeah.
Because
I think Sophie is more what we saw in Yellow Jacket, she can be terrifying.
And that's, again, and that's another actor I'm a big fan of, given not a lot to do here.
Because she doesn't have a bunch to do. So we've got, like, everybody has a personality trait. And we have emo girl, and I had them as pretty girl and nice pretty girl. Not that the other pretty girl is mean, but she's just kind of there.
Not as nice.
Yeah. And then jock and nerd with Cousin Rel. And you got Nick Frost as their teacher, who, in a role written for Ricky Gervais. So that was a little weird, because it's the character that Ricky Gervais plays in everything, you know, like in The Office, the original Office, and in Night at the Museum, like, oh, so we're smoking indoors now, are we? Oh, don't suppose you could think about... No, certainly not. And like, oh, yeah, you couldn't get Ricky Gervais, but Nick Frost was there. But, you know, this could all be really fun. And I think in some parts, maybe it is a little, but it just didn't rise to the heights of like a Final Destination. And
that's,
I think,
what
it's,
I wanted
maybe
from
just
this.
The characters are flat. So the idea in this is really fun, that if you blow the whistle or you hear somebody blow it, then you'll see a grim specter of how you are going to die. And then that grim specter will just kind of absorb you. And then that's you. So if you were going to die of old age, like one of the kills in this, then just ancient you comes and beats your ass. And then you are suddenly old and then you die. Like, that is a really cool idea.
And, yeah. And the fact that everybody has a different mode of death makes it visually interesting, which is awesome.
Yeah, the mechanics of that are, yeah, the mechanics
the,
that are
fun. The slow motion levitating car crash was awesome.
Yeah, it was
super creative. And it's like, well, that's where this movie, that's where, like, we were talking about this in text messages, like, that's where this movie gets me. It's like, there's these mechanics of that part of it that are super interesting. And like, and just, yeah, there's just a lot going on there. But then you get into the character part of it. The character part of it just is very, I don't know, it's weird. Because, like, you know, the guy who wrote this is Owen Edgerton, which, I mean, I don't know if you guys know him. Like, his
name sounds familiar.
He was an Austin guy. He and his wife left Austin, which I think it was, I don't know if it was after the election or if it was, I don't want to put words in Owen's mouth, because I mean, I know him. But it's sort of like they kind of had enough of Texas, I think, and they just kind of got the hell out of here. I think it was maybe the trans bill or something. I don't know what it was. There was something that triggered it. He just said that the hell with it. But he was kind of a fixture at Fantastic Fest for years and really good guy. I'm looking over at my bookshelf. I've got a couple of his books over there. And it's like, so he's a very creative and interesting thinker. So like the mechanics of the Final Destination-esque aspects of this are super interesting and creative and cool. Like they're really neat. But this just strikes me as being one of those ones where that part of the story is like super well thought out and creative and interesting. And it's like, but then you get these characters and you have to like be with them. And it's just sort of like, it's like, boy, is it just a lot to contend with. Cause you have like drug dealing pastor guy who.
Was there any reason for him to exist?
So that they could fail to make the ballsy decision at the end. I think he's only there for them to go, but it would be wrong to kill him. Like, that's the only reason that dude is in here. And he is, because this is a 90s movie and he would have been Timothy Oliphant.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did have that thought too. And I was like, you are not as hot as Timothy. I yelled at my TV.
A little too dead eyed.
I don't know what that says about me, but probably I should chill out a bit.
So they're all of the high schoolers are in their mid 20s.
And, which again is on point for a 90s throwback.
Yeah. And it just, all of it made me think, what if I'm not giving this movie enough credit and it's actually Hudson Hawking it, where it's doing the thing, a parody of the thing, so close and so subtle that you just go, Jesus, this is like a shitty 90s movie with the old teenagers giving each other shit all the time. Like, oh. Like, that would be brilliant, but I don't think that's what's happening. I just think this is people raised on the movies that I watched when I was already an adult.
Well, and like, and actually to that, but actually exactly to that point, the one standout or one of the big standouts, at least in my mind, was the guy who plays Rel, the guy, the actor, the Sky Yang. Like, I love that character. Like, I absolutely love him because he is that 80s character, but doesn't suck out loud. Like, you go back and watch Pretty in Pink, or go back and watch Revenge of the Nerds, or go back and watch any of those ones, and you're like, they're the kind of sympathetic kind of character or whatever else. Like, no, it sucks. They all suck, all of them. Go back and watch them now, and you're like, God, ugh, bleh. And so, like, you watch this, and you go, he has figured out how to put the mechanics into that character and just have him not be a shitty piece of garbage.
It helps that the script doesn't require him to, like, constantly be peeking in the girls' showers and stuff.
True. Yeah, there's no need for boob here aside from some like side boob. Like they would have try to just give you the gratuitous bullshit that the slash moves of the era. Yeah.
Yeah, he would have in the 90s when he would have been like the Jamie Kennedy guy. But just, you know, like after Scream when they all had to have that guy.
Or Mamas, Jason Mewes. Don't let your children grow up to be Jamie Kennedy guys. Let them grow up to be Seth Green guys.
Yeah. Whenever I think of minute of redheads.
Whenever I think of Jamie Kennedy, and I will think this until the day that I die, which is many, many years ago, leading up to Fantastic Fest, the guy, Brad Henderson, who produced a bunch of stuff. He works for one of the, I forget which producing house he works for now, based out of Florida. Really good guy. There, he got into it with Jamie Kennedy online about something or other. I don't know what the hell it was. Jamie Kennedy being a dipshit as per usual. Something, I still remember the details.
What?
But they were going back and forth or whatever else, and just, you know. And then at one point, Jamie Kennedy said, and I quote, and I will never forget this: "Why don't you know, just tweet like a man?" And it was like. So Brad put that on a T-shirt and brought it with him to Fantastic Fest, which was great, great fun.
Because be selling those shirts by the dozen.
Oh, it's just, yeah, it was just so. Whatever I think of Jamie Kennedy now, even though I love Randy, the character, very much, it's like, you know, I also love Hades and Hercules, but James Woods sucks ass. So it's sort of like, it's kind of one of those tricky sort of things. But the other thing I was going to mention too, and I guess I'm kind of going on the positive side of this because it is maybe just context of the writer, but the choice of using a Mayan death whistle as being a thing that, like, and there's a supernatural component to it is an interesting choice because it's sort of like it gets close to an area where you're like, are you placing some kind of a thing on a thing that you shouldn't be doing that? Like as like a white guy, like maybe you shouldn't do that. And it's like, but I don't think it gets that far. I don't think it's that.
Yeah, it doesn't get like Stephen King old wooden head level, but like you do kind of go, tread carefully when you see a movie like this.
If death had shown up like painted with a white chalk, like a naked figure with a long dreadlocks and painted their face with chalk and shit. Like, yeah, it could have gotten real insensitive real quick. I think it avoids it just by not getting into the culture aspect of it much at all.
Yeah. Well, yeah, getting
beyond
into just like
witchy grandma, right?
Yeah. The mythology of just like, okay, your death's going to come when you're 90. This whistle just lets it find you immediately, but you still suffer the same death. Cool. That's pretty generic.
Like, well, that's the thing. Like, I don't that's why I wanted to mention it. Cause it was like, I think he does a perfectly fine job of bringing in a thing, bringing in a concept, bringing in an idea. It's the same thing as a cursed object. It's the same thing as a haunted whatever the fuck. It's just, you know, you're doing something with something, and I don't think it gets in that area. Like, I kept thinking of, I know I've told you guys this before, but, you know, the most uncomfortable movie-going experience I've ever experienced in my life was Johnny Frank Garrett's last word at South by Southwest, which is a real guy, real serial killer guy who was on death row, a real guy who killed real people in Texas, not too far from Austin. And real guy, and this guy's made this movie that supposes that it was supernatural and he was possessed and that there was ghosts and demons and monsters and supernatural shit.
Oh, good God.
That caused this to occur. And when they premiered this movie, my friend Mark Martinez and I were sitting in that theater, and two rows down from us are fucking family members, people that knew people that this really happened, and then they proceed to put this in this movie. And he and I couldn't get out of the row at the end of it, so we were stuck there for the most unbelievably skin-curdling Q&A that you've ever imagined in your life. I will take 1,000 dipshits asking about what the budget was, or how, you know, asking Mary Elizabeth Winstead if filming a movie in New Mexico impacted her love life over sitting in that theater, which that happened to. But sitting in that theater,
that was too specific to be made up.
Guys
never get that question.
It's funny how that works. But yeah, they'll never get to that era. That level of Johnny Frank Garrett's last word, which is just will forever be the most uncomfortable I've ever been in a theater in my life. But I think that it's worth mentioning, because amazing. it is an interesting thing, because it's like, because after I watched this, I was like, okay, I want to know a little bit. And so I went and poked around a little bit. I didn't do a ton of reading, to be honest, but I did a little bit of poking around. And as near as I can tell, like, most people don't know what they're for. Like, they're just kind of a thing that they found, and they're like, it's a thing.
Is it true they don't make a loud noise?
It's supposed to be very quiet. Yeah, it's supposed to be like a thing you can't really hear. Like, it's like not necessarily on the spectrum, which maybe that's why it's called a death whistle. Like, maybe it's the idea that you're not, like, a normal person's not gonna hear it or something. But I don't really, beyond that, like, how the fuck am I know? And so it's like, and so I guess I'll bring all this up just to say that, like, I think it's okay for people that are big nerds to go and research things. Like, I mean, Guillermo del Toro is a great example of this, or Frank or Mike Mignola is a great example of this. I was going to say Frank Miller, but then I pulled that back.
Yeah, probably wise. Yeah.
But like, yeah, Mignola or Guillermo are great examples of this, where they will research. Mignola is a great example of this. He's got a library full of folklore shit from every corner of the world.
To go see that art exhibit, dude. That fucking ruled.
Yeah, it's just incredible. And you watch a documentary about it, which, I mean, I would recommend anybody watch. It's brought me to tears a few times. Like, he's a cranky old pain in the ass, but he's a beautifully creative human being. But I don't think he has a vicious, racially tone-deaf bone in his body when it comes to research and understanding folklore and kind of things. And I just don't think that Owen does either. But I just think it's interesting, because they do identify it as, like, an Aztec or a Mayan thing. And it's like, okay, well, all right. And so this is interesting, I guess.
Well, I think because this is an argument worth having, and I think this one we'll maybe be having more and more as we live in a world that continues to evolve, is that, like, yeah, it's going to be tougher and tougher to come up with, based on anything in reality, supernatural origins for things, but it's a tougher row to hoe to make up whole cloth. A thing that sounds old and like it,
yeah.
Like Pet Sematary isn't really that based on the idea of indigenous people from the United States, and yet it does have some idea of, like, this isn't just like people in the 70s decided you could bury your pets here and they come back because they were swingers. Like, that doesn't make sense. I mean, it makes as much sense as anything else. Which is the problem, right? Is that, like, it's only makes sense because it seems old. So do we just do the Lovecraft thing and you just make up these ancient civilizations that had some, you know, unnameable, unspeakable ritual that we are tapping into? Like, maybe that is just what we move to, but it is a curious problem that I think will maybe persist going forward. And yeah. I'm curious to see how it goes.
Vampires block Wi-Fi. The monsters can evolve.
Now, in my head, it was vampires, bleh, Wi-Fi.
That's his back of his Wi-Fi password, actually. It's bleh, it's outrageous.
I love the idea that the Twilight vampires are sparkly because they're loading.
Fuck, I got to change the combination of my luggage.
So I think what happened to me with this is I wasn't super invested and just kind of bumping along, like, okay, there's a slickness to this. This is just going to be what it is. This is what it is. I'm taking it in stride. But then they made just a series of choices that bugged me. And it starts with, we learn very clumsily that Goth Girl used to be a junkie. And she says, it's my fault my dad died. And I thought, and there's like car crash noises when she says that. Okay, well, how interesting is it if she is out driving high and runs into dad?
Like, oh, has a head-on that's collision. A better movie. Right?
Or how interesting is it if he is just, sorry, I forgot, but like,
well, no, just, I mean, if she was allegedly sober cabbing dad home from a party, but she had gotten high, like,
yeah, or even
awesome
just
level of guilt. You could
driving
just
home from a, she's driving home from a party high.
Ugh, amazing. Yeah.
And he's driving to work and she hits him. Like, it seemed like she was going to be directly responsible for her dad's death in some way. And then it was, I was overdosing and we were driving to the hospital and we had a heart attack or we had a car crash, some shit. She's like, it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't been overdosing. So it's my fault. And it's like, that's boring. That's like in the new, I Know How You Did Last Summer. Like, they didn't really have anything to do with the guy choosing to drive off the road. Like,
it's a Catholic guilt level of leap of logic.
Yeah, so that felt really weak. And that felt like stepping away from something interesting. And then having that, introducing shithead character, and then like, oh, we can transfer our death to someone, and like they think about it, and the one girl goes, we couldn't do that, that would be wrong, and the other two don't go fuck you and do it anyway. And maybe that doesn't help, maybe it does help, but to me that just rang so bizarre that they would make that choice. And then the final, this least interesting thing, is the guy is coming straight at them and like reaching out and slapping him with a bloody hand would have been so fucking dope. We're like, we just saw this guy get shredded in a like blur of messy
CGI. Oh, another
CGI.
Amazing scene. Yeah.
Yeah. We just saw this guy get totally shredded. So fuck the ethics that we were talking about earlier and smear the guy with the blood. And then maybe we pass the death on to the other person and now what do we do? Like, all those are very interesting things, but instead the villain, stop me if you've heard this one, contains the seeds of his own destruction. And what? Pretty much accidentally, like as accidentally as Anakin Skywalker does stuff in Phantom Menace, like
double
accidentally
one.
Kills himself. So none of our characters have to make an interesting choice or decision with that. So, yeah, and then, like, the mid-credits thing, like, there's going to be a sequel, like, please don't.
Oh, that just bummed me out, yeah.
The other thing that I would be remiss if I didn't bring up was, like, you know, and again, you know, God love Owen, but he has this thing about Halloween festivals, apparently, because a Bloodfest is that way, where it's like this outsized, just ridiculously, it's like the high school party that we always used to talk about with certain movies where, like, there's no party that exists like this. This is not a thing. Like with these, like with Bloodfest and this one, like this level of production, it's like Halloween Horror Nights is like, hey, where did you get the budget for that? Like sort of like, wow, it's this level of production and involvement and fire hazards you can think of, like all sort of thinking.
How did I forget about the corn maze that is like bigger than Labyrinth from Labyrinth?
Yeah, it's just like I said, I think Owen just has this thing about these, about Halloween festivals. I think he just like has this, like he wants to depict like the ideal ones. And, like he just has this thing about this, apparently. It's just like, because the Bloodfest is the same way. You're like, what the hell scale? Like, crying out loud.
I'm going to be the, I'm going to be the Midwestern native and say that corn mazes do get big here. Like, I mean, corn maze as a place for people to get lost works for me in a movie. Now, all the other bullshit around that, yeah, right, fine. But if you need someone to get lost in like 4 acres of land, that's to me more compelling than like the hedge maze in the
show. Hedge maze, like you cast a spell for shrubbery, like plus four to your house's value. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Eat this rat tail and your begonias will be amazing. Begonia.
That's a good comedy word.
It is kind of good.
Oh, but what was the topic? No.
Fuck, why not? Whistle. Anyway. Yeah.
You whistle while you work. Yeah, just taking all of the agency away from the people towards the end of it, just ends up making it kind of wet fart to the end. I mean, so watching this in Primate in the same batch was interesting because they both have this group of people who are getting picked off one by one. And one of them, I think, succeeds with that and the other one doesn't. And I think it is just the partly that, like, what time period is this set and what social class are these people in and how big is the town that they're in and what do their parents do for a living? Like, nothing in this movie added up at all, especially considering it was set in modern times. And then it, to me, the kills in this got really undercut by how, not just like CG, but like rubbery, kind of boneless CG. Like, I did not wince when the guy was getting slow motion torn apart by the junkyard shredder. And some of the scenes in Primate, I nearly passed out. Like, this just,
I do not envy that as someone that often experiences that.
None of this just seemed to have any weight to it. It should have been freaky as fuck for Nick Frost to just turn into like an end stage cancer patient. But it just didn't, because he didn't look like a cancer patient. He looked like Shrek. Which is the CG in this just made it so I could not get as squicked out by the violence as I wanted to. I think it's more in the direction of like the Primates of the World and the Cinderella movie, the Ugly Stepsister.
Oh, God, yeah.
Can make you feel something that this just could not for me.
Well, and it's the thing where, I don't know if I said it by text message or not, I'm not sure, but I kept thinking of my biggest takeaway was feeling like it reminded me of those, was it After Dark movie series that they tried for a while, where they had like multiple movies they did in the theaters for like 2 weeks. And
No.
This was like, I'm forgetting.
Oh, no, sorry. That's Six Films to Keep You Awake. No.
That's
like the Eight After Dark or whatever that was. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. They did it for a few years and then they tried to. So they, and I just admired their guts, but to try it.
Yeah.
And I remember I saw a few. I remember seeing a few of them in the theater. And then there's one, I think I might have a copy of it possibly. I don't know if I do or not, but the Deaths of Ian Stone, where it's like, it's a really cool idea. It's a really interesting idea. And it's really messes with your perception. And it's just a really cool, creative thing. But their ambitions are bigger than what they can depict. And so by the third act, it's kind of like, you get very undercut by that. Like the Grave Dancers is another one where like as a fucking campfire story, it's terrifying. It's really, really unsettling. And the first time through with the entities, it's like, blah, blah, it's awful. But by the end of it, you're like, well, that just is silly. And so it's sort of like, you just,
well, after that, you have to go through their union and their union's a bitch.
Well, and then the meetings, I mean, it's all under fluorescent lights, so monsters don't look nearly as scary under fluorescent lights, you know, sort of like this whole thing, and then somebody forgot to get the donuts and the coffee's cold, and it's the whole thing. This feels like that, where it's like, I think it fits into that realm, where like, you've got a good idea, there's some creative things that are going, but just the context is bigger than, or the ambitions are way bigger than the context. And so like, had they gone the more smaller, more rural, somber, more folky, kind of more dark song direction, then I think you can get a little bit more meat onto that part of it, to your point, Joshua. And then like I said, I think it's just very, 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 very creative and interesting idea that's sort of kind of waylaid by these kind of archetypal characters that I just think in this day and age is you can do more with characters. And so, it's just kind of one of those things.
And like when you replicate a format or a genre, like a subgenre that you really enjoyed, you don't have to port over all the flaws.
Yeah.
You know, like you don't have to take the kind of slick, shallow, shitty characters and like lovingly re-render that, you know, like either start them seeming shitty and shallow and then give them more depth, you know, like the Faculty does, or call out that they're shitty and shallow, or don't make them shitty and shallow. Just like make some good characters, and you don't have to do it that way just because that's how like Urban Legend and Scream 4 and I Still Know What You Did Last September did. This is like a 5 for me. It's It is fine. It just, those couple of bad ideas that just weaken the story, and then the effects just got to me.
All right. I'll give this a 5, and I will say it's a generous 5. In as much as, like, for all the flaws we pointed out, where it's like, I like the idea of your death can chase you down faster once you hear this thing, and then we have to watch some graphic depiction without the equipment or surrounding the things, the machinations of it existing around you. Like, that's cool and crazy gory. Like, that final destination aspect is interesting. Like, I think there's some fun stuff there. I don't think the execution hits it. I think the... Yeah, your characters are... I don't know. It seems like there's a lot of fun ideas for the supernatural parts that were, like, raring to go, and then the rest was sort of built around it to sort of fill it out. I don't know. Who knows, right? That could be totally different. But I like the idea here. If they did another one, and, like, this could be suddenly the, what was it, like, Witchboard 2 or something like that was fucking awesome. And so, like, who knows? Like, but it's not a terrible idea. I just want to see, like, the right person, like, grab the reins. So, for that, 5. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm in that same ballpark. There's some things that I really like in this. There's some things that I appreciate, some good craft and ideas. And so, like, that part of the movie is really cool. It's just, like, yeah, the character part of it just severely undercuts it. It kind of, like, it reminded me a little bit of, like, the second Smile movie. Where I was just sort of like, I don't fucking care about any of you people.
Oh, I like that.
It's like, well, just meh. So it's, yeah, it's a creative idea. It's an interesting idea, and could really work if the scale was the right scale, I think. And then also just the goddamn pastor. It's just like that part of it. It's like, you gotta give, you're gonna be your character with this thing, this one sentence byline about he's like a drug dealing pastor guy and he's this, that, he's that, and everywhere else, then you gotta, if that's gonna be one of your characters, you gotta give me something that tells me why he can still operate. Like, what has he got on somebody? There's gotta be something else. And it's just sort of like, as it stands, he's like, you just sort of like, you've kind of created him in a character creator in an RPG game kind of a situation. And it's sort of like, okay, well, that's all we got. And it's like, that's dull. And then, you know, not for nothing, but the whole Flatliners thing was sort of a little odd. It was kind of like,
well, so that's the final destination thing too. Like,
yeah, like drive the ambulance into the water, and then, like, she dies, then we bring her back, and then we can stop the chain. It's like, maybe. And sort of, so yeah, it's just, you know, that part of it, the core story is interesting and creative, and it gets kind of undercut by some of the character stuff and some of the, you know, where it all sits. I didn't, you know, the effects didn't bother me as much. I mean, like, I fully get what you say, but it's like, it didn't bother me as much. But it is a matter of context and scale. Like, I kept thinking, like, the Death of Ian Stone as being an example of that. But so yeah, I'm gonna say like 5.25, just to mess with Matt, really. 5.25 out of 10. Out of 10.
I will also add that one of the many ways in which I know that I picked the right lady to be my wife is we watched this together, for one. We had a great time kind of bouncing off each other with it. And there's a moment where Nick Frost's character picks up the whistle and he's like, this is a weird thing to be found in a student's estate. And the, like, music swells and it zooms in on it as if it's luring him in. And my wife goes, blow me. That, oh my God, how we laughed. like it's, we joked about how it's not as impertinent as the cookies in Alice in Wonderland that say eat me, but
it's up there.
Similar vibe.
So that's the kind of thing where, like, that's the kind of thing, Josh, where it's like, it's such a specific kind of, like, yeah, I've been trying to catch up on Night Manager, which if you're a fan of John Le Carré, like Tinker Taylor, it's really good. It's Hugh Laurie's fucking amazing in it, and Tom Hiddleston and everybody else in there is really good. But at one point, there's one scene with Tom Hiddleston, and it's very tense. It's a very suspenseful thing. And Tom Hiddleston kind of turns his expression changes slightly. Kristen looks up from where she's working on one of her classes, whatever. She looks up, she just goes, "Joe's sad, Loki." Like, just busted all the tension right open. I'm like, "God damn it!" Like, mm-hmm. now my tenseness is completely obliterated. Thank you very much, dear. Well, yeah, it's a good reminder that you got the right people around. Right. You know what I'm trying to say.
Exactamente. All right, so that's things that we talked about, and we are going to come back with some more things to talk about more later. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
So next week we are going to watch some new stuff. We've got We Bury the Dead and Shelby Oaks, I think, are both on
Shudder. Nope. Hulu.
Yes, yeah. The Hulu, which has been like eaten by the Disney Plus app at this point. I only say that because it's hilarious to go into Disney Plus.
Oh my God, it's so
Would you like so funny. To see Star Wars The Phantom Menace or Martyrs? You're like, yeah.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, mine. I turned off the parental filter, went back to the home screen. I was like, whoa, no. Whoops.
Yeah, kind of beautiful. So We Bury the Dead, Shelby Oaks on Hulu, and Monkey's Magic Merry-Go-Round, which is on Screenbox. And I know it's not a place that we usually recommend stuff, but we're gonna do a free trial for this one. I think it's worth it. So We Bury the Dead, Shelby Oaks, Monkey's Magic Merry-Go-Round.
Well done. I've been dressed
this entire time, and I will say...
And if you are a regular listener of the show, perhaps you're on the Slaughterhouse Princess Discord, I would like you to send me your best mispronunciation of Monkey's Magical Merry-Go-Round, because I will read those at the beginning of the next episode. That being said, we will have a short film, as per usual. This one, I'm excited about this. I've been trying to do this for like three episodes. You Were Never Yours. Random find on YouTube that surprised me, and I'm curious to see what y'all think. As per usual, that will be available on horrorshowhotdog.com. If you just want to go check it out there, you can find links to all of our various social medias, minimal as they might be, and places to send an email if you have suggestions, comments, insults, whatever. And all that being said, as far as you all know, I've been Matt this entire time.
And he says sorry.
Oh, and I'm sorry. Fuck.
That's okay.
I was like already filling in ratings from the last three movies. I'm totally present.
It all makes sense. So it's sort it out in the morning. This is Charlie Dunn Austin. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Dive into things you like. That's what I have to say about that. So be good. We'll talk to you later. Take care. Bye-bye.
But for now,
but for.
We have but for.
What's a but sack for? But. Pooping, silly.
I'm so glad that my children now will do that. Like,
oh, just dumbass dad jokes?
On either end. Yeah, the but for particularly.
Oh, excellent.
Do you have your backpack? Yes. And your coat? Yes. And your boots? Yes. And the but for? And she doesn't know why it has to be in that accent.
Yeah.
But she looks at me with doe eyes and goes, "What's a butt for?"
Or, perfect.
Yeah, like she plays. She commits to the bit. It's good.
That's awesome. That's a special thing. Is when people learn how to like, it'll be funnier to go along with the joke than to act smart enough to get the joke ahead of time. Like, oh, yeah. That's a beautiful moment.